Hello everyone, welcome back. So in this chapter and the next chapters, we will look at some of the acts that are important from the compliance and the privacy perspective. So this helps you to get a fair bit of understanding about the different compliance laws that we talked about, so that it makes it more relatable to the current scenario. So in this chapter, we will look at the laws, acts, and some of the regulations. So this is going to be a power-packed session. So what will be the agenda? The agenda this time would be first to look at the SOC Act, which is the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Now, this was a revolutionary act that was passed so as to have sufficient amount of privacy and controls. You have the GLBA. That is the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. We will also look at the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. The Data Protection Act, popularly known as the GDPR regulations. This is very popular in European Union. So if you have a multinational organization who has to do business in Europe and the region surrounding it, most of the compliance organizations require GDPR compliance. In fact, even organizations in India who do business globally, so think of companies in the healthcare space, in the pharma and the manufacturing space, these type of companies would generally require a GDPR compliance, because most of the operations or some crucial operations operate out of the European Union. You then have the Federal Information Management Act, and we'll talk more about it. There is an important act, which is the Information Technology Act of 2000. Now, this again is a pretty important act to comply for. In fact, if you are doing business in India, generally all the banking customers, the insurers, the non-banking financial customers, they would require the business operations to comply with the Information Technology Act 2000. Again, many different provisions with regards to PII data, encryption, security standards, data transfer, data storage mechanism, having a specialized backup center, a disaster recovery center, and so on. But be mindful of the fact that these acts have been passed to ensure the interests of the customers, to ensure that organizations maintain right kind of disclosures with the regulators. They have the right kind of methodologies so that the proper norms are maintained, and the proper disclosures, as I said, to the regulators, to the governing bodies are maintained so as to protect the investor sentiment. The whole bottom line or the whole purpose of this is to have customer confidence and at the same time maintain credibility of the organization in front of not just only the stakeholders, that is the shareholders, but also all the relevant stakeholders. So this would mean buyers, suppliers, vendors, etc., etc., right? So let's look at the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. So the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, now as I said, so this was passed in 2002, and why this was passed, let's look at that. So a number of financial scandals took place in the late 90s and the early 90s. So financial scandals involved some of the big major companies, so companies like Enron, Tyco International, and so on, right? So this led to a lot of loss, not just in terms of the commercial loss, but also in terms of the investor sentiment. Now, this is really important, because if customers don't maintain the proper disclosure norms, and all of a sudden the wealth that was created by the company just erodes in a matter of few days, this is actually alarming, not just for the investors, but for the overall country as such, right? So that's what happened in case of Enron and Tyco International. Hence, the Sabins-Oxley Act of 2002 was enacted in response to the crisis to restore the public confidence in financial reporting. As I said, it is not just important for an organization to do business, but conduct the business in an ethical manner, ensure that all the regulations are met, the disclosures are met, the correct amount of financial reporting is done, and it is done with the stamp of the CEO or the CFO. We spoke about it in the previous chapters where we said that in today's era, the CEO is personally held responsible and is liable to sign on the income statements, right, and the P&Ls and the balance sheets. So why is this? Because this has been enacted so that to include a sense of ownership. It was very easy in, as I said, in the early 90s for the CEO to just put their hand up saying that, oh, this was something to be done by other departments and not me. But what has happened is with these acts coming into picture, the CEO and the important stakeholders are now held personally liable, because at the end of the day, they are supposed to look at the company income statements, the financial reportings, the disclosures, etc., etc. So, named after sponsors, so Senator Paul Sabins and Representative Michael Oxley, the SOC, this is popularly known as the SOC Act, aims at improving the accuracy and reliability of disclosures. Now, what kind of disclosures? We will look at this. There are different titles in which the SOC Acts operate, and it is considered as a landmark piece of legislation. One of the most substantial corporate regulations since the 1930s. As I said, the world was rocked by the financial disclosures in the early 90s, and the SOC Act is a response to that. So the Act mandates stricter standards for publicly traded companies, maintaining the right kind of financial reporting, the executive accountability with, say, the CEO and the CFO ensuring that the right level of disclosures are maintained, and also the internal records, the internal audits, etc. are maintained, and the books of accounts are really kept clean. So this is, as I said, a landmark act. More importantly for the publicly traded companies, and with a clear focus on the financial reporting and the disclosure standards. There were various regulatory bodies like the Securities and the Exchange Commission and the Public Company Accountability Accounting Oversight Board oversee the compliance with the SOC regulation. So the Act, as I said, it doesn't mean anything by its own. So it's then looked upon by various regulators, the market makers, etc., to ensure that they get the right amount of data and the right kind of data to ensure the cleanliness and the hygiene of the financial books of accounts. So what are the objectives of the Act? So as I said, because we were faced with a lot of loss of investor confidence in the early 90s. So the first and the topmost objective of the Act was to restore public trust and confidence. Because there were public traded companies, there were a lot of funds involved, a lot of wealth involved in these companies, and irregular reporting standard meant that if the regulator would take some action on these companies, that would erode the wealth of the investors. So the first or the topmost objective, as I said, was to maintain the public trust and confidence. The second was to improve the corporate governance. Now, corporate governance is a huge term. What does it include? So enhance transparency and completeness of the financial statements, and not just the completeness, but also the disclosures and the right amount of disclosures to the regulators. It is important that the disclosures are done in a timely manner. So say, for example, if the company is about to release the annual balance sheet and the P&L. Now, when this disclosure has to be made, at what time, what amount of disclosures have to be made, say disclosures with regards to any major activity in a company, etc., etc. So that involves complete transparency. So the Act also had one of the objectives to improve the corporate governance. The third was to ensure that the company executives were aware of the material information emanating from well-controlled environment. And this meant that sponsorship from right at the top level by the CEO and the CFO, so that the company can be held responsible, that the management can be held responsible, accountable for material information that is filled in the SEC compliance and released to the investors. So as I said, this brought about a lot of ownership by the top management to ensure that their neck is on the line if anything which was supposed to be filled is filled with the right amount of standards in the SEC filings. Now, SEC filings are the one that are submitted to the regulators. So to comply with the SOC Act, what should organizations do? First and the foremost is to identify their business processes as they relate to the financial reporting at all levels. Second, after identification, is to document the processes, document the process flow, the design of the controls, the internal control mechanisms. So document basically all the internal processes. The third is evaluate the effectiveness of these controls. So organizations would have some kind of internal checks and mechanisms. So say, for example, if a procurement department is releasing some kind of a purchase order for the purchase of IT goods. Now, IT goods means, say, servers. Let's keep the example simple, right? So organizations need to maintain an internal process. First would be to get a business note, a business justification, followed by a purchase intent, then followed by a formal purchase order in the system, doing a proper vendor evaluation, vendor registration, etc., before the purchase order gets released, and then maintain the proper contractual agreements in place. So this is a fairly simple five steps that I've mentioned, but this is quite complex when it is implemented in organizations. So the third was, as I said, to evaluate the effectiveness of these controls. So are all the controls in place good enough, or are there any loopholes through which certain backend procedures can be triggered or not? And then evaluate the operating effectiveness of the internal controls. So there are two things, right? So when I said you look at releasing the purchase order to the external vendor, so that is more outbound. But also what goes inside, or the entire internal process or the internal controls, is also equally important. So things like a proper business justification, a signature or a sponsorship by the business sponsor, getting three different vendor evaluations, etc., etc. So these are more controls to do with the internal processes. So the SOC Act had two things: one, obviously the external controls, but also the internal controls. Identify and remediate any internal controls weakness over financial reporting. So again, you have identified what are the internal controls required, what are the internal controls established, and then you evaluate the effectiveness of these controls. Obtain attestation from an independent auditor. Now, this is very important. Quite often what companies feel is that they've formed an internal audit committee, maybe a separate compliance team, etc. But it is important that they have an independent auditor similar to a maker-checker concept. Now, maker-checker is a concept where someone makes it, but there's a third party who checks it, right? So, and quite often you see this terms in, say, big tenders where there are big landmark projects involved. So say, for example, if an organization has to ensure digitization of, say, some of its financial assets. So what they would typically do is they would first employ a knowledge partner to study the existing procedures, look at the potential gaps, evaluate, and then come up with their recommendation. And the second is appointment of another vendor who does the actual implementation. This is done because, as I said, someone who makes it or someone who's done the internal assessment knows the loopholes or the gaps involved. So companies would generally have another vendor do the actual implementation. So this is to ensure that a maker-checker concept, an independent auditor or an independent third party is the one who is certifying it, right? So that is important to obtain an attestation from an independent auditor. Establish procedures for ongoing monitoring to enable certification. Now, all the checks and balances in place, but as we've discussed, that compliance is not just a point-in-time event, it's a continual process. So the SOC Act also had one of the objectives to establish the procedures for ongoing monitoring of the certifications. Now, what does this act include? So this act, as I said, includes 11 titles, and we will spend some time to look at the 11 titles, each addressing various aspects of corporate responsibility, financial reporting, and more importantly, penalties for non-disclosures. So as I said, organizations need to maintain the right level of disclosures, but more importantly, what are the some of the actions for non-disclosures? So these get covered under the penalties. It also tasked the SEC, that is the Securities and Exchange Commission, with enforcing its requirements, both on financial reporting, the timeliness, the correctness of the information, etc., etc. So what are these 11 titles? So the SOC titles cover different areas, such as public accounting oversight, auditor's independence. So how can an auditor function independently of the internal workings? So just like a third party who would audit, that's what an auditor is supposed to do. But what are the powers that an auditor has to enforce on the company? Because there were certain norms that were flaunted in case of the early 90s companies, where the auditors were also hand in glove with the management. Hence, the auditor independence was a very important term, a very important section in case of the SOC Act. The other important areas that the titles cover include the corporate responsibility, that is the attestation by the top management, the financial disclosures, what has to be disclosed, when it has to be disclosed, the rightness of the information, also address any conflict of interest, and fraud and accountability. Now, conflict of interest would mean, say, a CEO or any top official in a company buying a lot of shares in an organization, because, say, the CEO is prohibited from doing that because he knows the internal workings. Hence, that becomes a conflict of interest, and that could lead to insider trading. The SOC also introduced stricter standards for publicly traded companies, emphasize the importance of accurate financial reporting and the internal controls. So let us look at all these 11 titles or the 11 sections. The first, establish the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, popularly known as the PCAOB, to oversee the auditors and enforce the compliance. Now, what happened previously was auditors, as I said, were sometimes hand in glove with the company management. So any kind of lacuna in the process, shortcomings were never disclosed in the SEC filings. Hence, the PCAOB wanted to oversee the auditors, their independent reports, and then enforce the compliance. Title 2 or Section 2 sets standards for the auditor's independence and addresses the conflict of interest, audit approvals, and reporting requirements. As we spoke about, auditor having independent right to attest the books of account, to look at the internal processes, and report all the conflict of interest. Conflict of interest, the simple example that we spoke about, someone having a higher position in the organization, knowing beforehand what the financial health of the organization is, and depending upon that, they could take, say, any financial actions in the stock market. Say, for example, if the company is about to release their quarterly results, and someone in the top position of the company purchasing a lot of shares before the results. So that happens to be a conflict of interest. So this had, as I said, one of the important criteria was to address the conflict of interest. The third is to mandate individual responsibility for corporate financial reporting accuracy, and define the roles of auditor and the corporate officers. Equally important was to know the accuracy of the reporting standard. As I said, in the SEC filings, what had to be exactly written, what kind of data, the correctness of the data was very crucial. The fourth was requirement for enhanced financial reporting, internal controls, and timely disclosures. So two aspects, both were addressed. One, the correctness, the accuracy of the financial reporting, and also the timely disclosures. Say an example that, say, one of the directors of the company has resigned, right? So that kind of timely disclosures has to be given or has to be written in the SEC filing and to be disclosed to the regulators at the same time. The fifth was to address the conflict of interest in securities analysis to restore investor confidence. So we spoke about it. The sixth section was to define the SEC's authority in restoring investor confidence and penalties for securities professionals, right? So getting the right amount of disclosures in a timely manner was important. And if companies or organizations fail to do that, then what are the repercussions for such kind of companies? Mandating the studies and reports on the various financial and market aspects was again one of the important sections here. Title 8 or Section 8 looked at introduction of criminal penalties for corporate frauds, tampering, and a important policy known as the whistleblower policy. Now, this again has been taken at a highest level because there are penalties involved for individuals engaging into, say, corporate fraud. A special policy known as the whistleblower policy has been enacted. You would see this in most of the organizations. Even in India, you look at, say, the Tata Group or any company, they would have a whistleblower policy in place. Now, what does it mean? A whistleblower is someone internal to the organization who has spotted some mishaps, maybe in the internal reporting standards, in their internal processes, or also maybe he or she wants to name certain people engaging into fraudulent activities. The whistleblower would just write a note to the compliance team with all the evidences, and the name of the whistleblower would never be disclosed. There would be a separate compliance committee who would look into this, all the allegations made by the whistleblower. But this was a very critical or a key section in the SOC Act, which has a very good effect on the overall compliance standards. Title 9 looked at enhancing penalties for white collar crimes. More importantly, things like, say, corporate routing of funds, which is difficult to track. So there were penalties involved, and failure to certify a financial reporting also led to different amount of penalties. Section 10 involved the CEOs to sign the corporate tax returns. Now, as I said, it was important for the top management to put their word, have their ownership and responsibility to ensure the compliance processes. So the Section 10 involved the CEOs to sign the corporate tax returns so that they are held accountable. So the idea is for them to overlook all the filings, the corporate tax returns that were filed, and ensure that they were done in accordance with the reporting standards. And the last section looked at identifying corporate frauds as criminal offenses and revising the sentencing guidelines. So these were the 11 titles in the SOC Act. There was also SOC sections 302 and 404 of the SOC that are particularly significant for the information security, so which required the CEO and the CFOs to certify the financial report accuracy and assess the internal controls and ensure that those were effectively in place. As we discussed, that the Act focused on the CEO and the CFO to have their ownership and their attestation in terms of the reports. So specifically, the Section 302, something to remember of Section 302 and 404, which relates to information security. The SOC had a global impact, influencing financial governance laws, not just in the US, but also in other countries like, say, Japan, Germany, France, India, South Africa. And so prompting companies listed on the US stock exchange to comply with these kind of requirements. As I said, in today's environment where companies operate in a global environment, maintaining these disclosures, compliance with the SOC Act is important for doing business. A simple case, say a company having operations, a US-based company having operations in India, they have to adhere to the norms of the US as well as India. And some of the things that were mentioned in the Act were actually relevant for companies doing business. So proper disclosures, the timely disclosures, accuracy of information, the whistleblower policy, attestation by the top management, etc., etc. Addressing the conflict of interest, getting the customer or the investor confidence back. So these were relevant for businesses operating throughout the world. The challenges in implementing the SOC included conflicting opinions on its benefits and cost. So obviously this was not just a simple policy that had to be implemented. There were proper frameworks in place, and it required a massive amount of effort in the entire organization to comply to this Act. So there was a lot of effort involved, a lot of cost involved in terms of setting up these frameworks, and with opponents citing that reduced competitiveness, a lot of time getting wasted, while on the other side, some of the proponents cited reasons like investor confidence and legal recourse. But however, as I said, this was important, and important for organizations to comply so that the business and the investor confidence remains intact.